KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump talks of retaking the Panama Canal, and his Secretary of State Marco Rubio visited Panama to deliver a message. Our colleague Ari Shapiro is in Panama, and it's Morning Edition from NPR News. Courts dealt the president a setback by blocking his effort to freeze congressionally approved federal funding. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. We'll ask a legal scholar how far Trump may be able to push his presidential power. Plus, we question Israel's ambassador to the United Nations about Gaza's future as the ceasefire deal moves into its second phase. And some kids in Los Angeles process their trauma from the wildfires through play. It is Monday, February 3rd. Happy birthday to reggaeton singer Daddy Yankee. He is 48 years old today. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Employees in Washington, D.C., who work for the U.S. Agency for International Development have been told to stay home today. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports tech billionaire Elon Musk has targeted the organization amid efforts to reform the federal government.
He definitely has big intentions here. He says Doge is in the process of specifically shutting down USAID, and he emphasizes that he could not do that without the support of the president. He actually said he went over it with Trump a few times. He asked him, was he sure? Musk didn't mention any statute or authority that would allow the president to basically skip Congress and shut down the agency unilaterally.
That's NPR's Franco Ordonez reporting. Businesses along the U.S. southern border say they're concerned about the 25% tariffs on Mexican imports that are set to take effect on Tuesday. Angela Cochurga from member station KTEP reports from El Paso.
The border is home to many manufacturers and supply chain businesses in both the U.S. and Mexico. The American automotive industry uses some parts that go back and forth across the border multiple times in building vehicles. U.S. businesses on the border also provide logistics, trucking, and warehousing services in this region. Jerry Pacheco, the CEO of the Border Industrial Association, says those businesses will feel the impact of tariffs.
They may not want to hire extra people until they see what the effect of tariffs is going to have. So it trickles completely through the supply chain.
Cross-border manufacturing in this region also includes U.S. companies that make consumer electronics as well as medical devices in Mexico. For NPR News, I'm Angela Cochurga in El Paso.
Stocks on Wall Street opened sharply lower this morning as investors try to assess the potential fallout from President Trump's new trade war. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow plummeted more than 600 points in early trading.
President Trump has ordered import taxes ranging from 10 to 25% on all goods coming into the U.S. from Mexico, Canada, and China. The tariffs are set to take effect tomorrow and could raise the price of imported liquor, lumber, and thousands of other products. Exports from the U.S. could also take a beating, as Canada and Mexico have promised to retaliate with tariffs of their own. Trump acknowledged the tariffs could cause some pain. He opted for a lower tax on Canadian crude oil in an effort to minimize the effect on gasoline prices. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce said in a statement that while Trump is right to focus on problems such as illegal drugs and immigration, tariffs are not the answer. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow was down 604 points. This is NPR News in Washington. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is scheduled to meet with President Trump at the White House today. Netanyahu is the first foreign leader to visit Trump since he took office last month. The two leaders are expected to discuss a wide range of issues, including the ceasefire in Gaza and negotiations aimed at the second phase of the agreement. North Korea is condemning Secretary of State Marco Rubio for branding it a rogue state and vowed an unspecified response. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports it marks Pyongyang's first official comments about the new Trump administration.
State media quoted the foreign ministry, which called Secretary Rubio's remarks a grave political provocation. The report was apparently in response to remarks Secretary Rubio made on the Megyn Kelly show. On the other hand, the report said that Rubio's remarks simply confirmed that U.S. policy towards North Korea remains hostile, and Pyongyang would have been more surprised if he had said anything favorable about it. The ministry also criticized U.S. plans for a new missile defense system, saying it would force the North to beef up its own military. Pyongyang has not responded to President Trump's suggestion that he's interested in trying to restart talks with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
Emergency crews have been deployed to the Greek island of Santorini after a spike in seismic activity raised concerns about a potential earthquake. Officials say more than 200 underwater earthquakes have been recorded within the last several days. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News. In Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include National Geographic Lindblad Expeditions, committed to taking travelers deeper into the wonders of planet Earth. Each expedition cruise is guided by a diverse team. natgeoexpeditions.com/cruises.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Coming up, how are kids in Los Angeles dealing with the area's wildfires?
We begin with the multiple confrontations the United States has provoked with its North American neighbors and allies.
President Trump announced 25% tariffs on goods from Canada and Mexico, launching a trade war. And a top U.S. diplomat has followed up on the president's demand to take over the Panama Canal. Panama has controlled the U.S.-built canal for decades. The president began talking of retaking it as part of a new expansionist agenda, which appeared after his election. Panama's president says this is not up for discussion, but Secretary of State Marco Rubio spent yesterday discussing it.
He was in Panama, and our colleague Ari Shapiro is in Panama City. Ari, good morning.
Hey, Steve.
Thanks for joining us. What did the secretary do yesterday?
The biggest event on his schedule was this meeting with the president of Panama, where apparently Rubio delivered an ultimatum. And I say apparently because Rubio actually did not make any public comments about the canal yesterday. Hmm. But according to a State Department spokesperson, Rubio delivered the message that President Trump has made a preliminary determination that China has too much influence over the canal. He says that violates international treaties. And unless there are immediate changes, the U.S. will do what it has to protect its rights. Trump added this yesterday.
We're going to take it back or something very powerful is going to happen.
By the way, Steve, quick fact check on Trump's claims of Chinese influence. While a company based in Hong Kong does operate ports at either end of the canal, Panama runs the canal itself, not China, and there is no Chinese military presence, as Trump has falsely claimed on social media.
Yeah, I guess I should also note here, the United States, at least the president, is not taking the view of we have these concerns, solve them or we will act. He's saying we're going to take it back. So how are Panama's leaders reacting?
After the meeting yesterday, President Jose Raul Mulino said Panama's sovereignty is not in question. And then he gave what you could interpret as kind of a dig at the United States. He's saying, I invited the State Department to promote investment in this country so they can't complain later that investments are coming from other countries. That quote doesn't mention China by name, but you can kind of read between the lines there.
What are you hearing from the Panamanian people?
It's this wave of nationalism, flags flying everywhere, and protests in the streets. I attended a couple marches that shut down main streets here in Panama City. One was organized by the Teachers Union, where I met a woman named Mylene Shakespeare, and I asked what she wants Americans to know. Here's what she said.
Nosotros hemos salido a la calle a defender nuestra patria. El canal de Panamá es para los panameños. Ni gringo ni gringuero, Panamá primero.
She says, we are taking to the streets to defend our country. The Panama Canal is for Panamanians. Then you hear her recite this rhyming slogan people had been chanting in the march. Ni gringo, ni gringuero, Panama primero. Basically, no Americans, Panama first. So big picture here, the U.S. is not backing down from Trump's threats. Panama is not caving. And the stakes are huge. 40% of all U.S. container traffic goes through the Panama Canal. So it's pretty remarkable for these two countries to be in such a standoff, given how close the U.S. and Panama have been for decades.
It would seem that Panama might be enough for a foreign trip, but where else is Rubio going?
On to El Salvador, Guatemala, Costa Rica, and the Dominican Republic, where he plans to talk about migration and drug trafficking. He's the first Hispanic Secretary of State. The State Department says this underscores Trump's message that it's a 21st century of American greatness and countering China.
NPR's Ari Shapiro will be hosting All Things Considered from the edge of the Panama Canal later today. He's in Panama City. Thanks, Ari.
Thanks, Steve.
We've been reporting on President Trump's many moves since he took office last month, and we are also reporting on those actions which test the limits of his authority. Last week, for example, his administration tried to freeze federal funding already approved by Congress. Courts intervened. The Office of Management and Budget rescinded the memo ordering the funding freeze, at least for now. But White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt insisted the president's orders remain, quote, in full force and effect, unquote, so a federal judge may yet hear argument. To consider some of the ways this could play out, we've called Jillian Metzger, a law professor at Columbia who has had a couple of different roles at the Justice Department and the Office of Legal Counsel, including as acting assistant attorney general. That office serves as legal advisor to the executive branch. Good morning, Professor. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So putting your OLC hat on, can a president freeze federal funding already approved by Congress?
I think the short answer to that is no, with, of course, as usual for lawyers, some qualifications. The governing statute here makes it clear that the president can't just delay funding that Congress has approved for policy reasons, which is what the president appears to have done here. And as a result, I think it goes beyond the authorities that the president has. There might be some specific statutes that, you know, grant appropriations that are compassed by the freeze that give the president discretion, but the kind of categorical across-the-board move that was done here, I think it was outside of statutory authority.
So you could see it as a setback when the courts immediately block the president, but I may be asking you to speculate here, but could that actually be the point? I mean, as part of the plan here to get to a court with an expansive view of his authority?
I think it may very well be. I mean, I think we're seeing some very bold and aggressive assertions of presidential authority, notwithstanding statutory and constitutional law to the contrary. And when it comes to funding, there are members of Trump's administration that have asserted that the president has some kind of inherent authority to control and refuse to spend money that Congress has appropriated. So this may very well be the signal of a first step to try and get that to court, although in this particular case, they've rescinded the memo, so this may not have been the vehicle that they had ideally chosen to try and make that move with.
Okay, but I'm thinking about the so-called Muslim ban. And of course, they deny that that was a Muslim ban, but we'll just call it that. That's what people think of, that Trump issued in his first term as president. His first executive order was struck down, so was his second. But then the third one was upheld by the court after lower courts rejected it. So do you expect OMB to keep trying?
I would expect them to keep trying. I think it seems like it's a central theme of this administration to try and be pulling back on funding and to make some very, very bold assertions of presidential authority that they're trying to get before the Supreme Court. I don't think actually the Supreme Court will likely go for this argument about inherent presidential funding, but there are certainly other moves that the president is making that have more resonance in recent Supreme Court decisions.
Okay, I was going to ask you about that. On this question of the funding, if you think about the court, again, I'm asking you to speculate, you don't think that the court would be amenable to that argument about...
I don't think so. I mean, of course, you know, predictions, take them for what they're worth. But the court has recently asserted Congress's very broad control overfunding, and it is clear if you look at the Constitution that the power of the purse lies with Congress, not with the president. I would be surprised if the court went for such a bold and categorical assertion of inherent funding.
But the president, another big sort of area of interest for the president is trying to reshape the federal workforce, and there have been a number of moves in that direction. Do you have a sense of how this Supreme Court has looked on questions of federal worker protections and whether people can be placed on leave, for example, as he recently did with USAID and other agencies for that matter?
Yeah, I don't know in terms of recent decisions that deal with leave, but the Supreme Court has been very assertive recently about the president having a constitutional power to remove high-ranking officials and been asserting very broad kind of unitary executive power in that sense over the personnel of the executive branch. I think when you're talking about some of the moves they're making in this area, there are also statutory authorities that the president has that have to be taken into account, for example, to make exceptions to the civil service and some of the moves that he's been making. I think we're going to have to see just how those statutory and constitutional arguments play out.
That is Jillian Metzger. She's a constitutional law professor at Columbia University. Professor Metzger, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Some parents and caregivers around Los Angeles have noticed their kids behaving differently since the Los Angeles fires. From LAist News, Libby Rainey reports.
It's a typical morning at the Children's Center at Caltech in Pasadena. 4 and 5-year-olds are playing with Legos and whispering to each other. Their teacher, Jose Osorio, spots 2 kids playing with a pile of colorful blocks and scarves and asks what they're up to. We're not naming them because of their young ages.
We're making a house.
A house, okay. And can you tell us about the scenery? What's happening here? Where are you guys?
There's the ocean and that's fire.
That's fire. This has been pretty typical in the classroom since the LA fires burned through thousands of homes.
The fire will go away when the blue ocean will meet there later.
Some of the kids in this classroom have been displaced, and they're processing what happened in part through playtime. People who work with young children who have trauma say they use play because they might not yet have the words to express how they're feeling. Melissa Breimer is an expert on children's response to disasters at the UCLA Duke National Center for Child Traumatic Stress.
That's their way of kind of processing what's been happening for them. We use our words. They use their play.
This fire play also happened after the Tubbs Fire destroyed thousands of homes in Northern California in 2017. In the aftermath, the nearby Children's Museum of Sonoma County hosted a fire truck exhibit. Museum founder Colette Michaud was brought to tears recounting the experience of one young boy who had lost his home.
And he was standing on the fire truck. He had this big smile on his face and he looked at his dad. He said, "Dad, I'm calling 911. They're coming to save our house."
According to child trauma experts, one reason play can be so transformative is because it puts children in the driver's seat. In playtime, they get to determine the outcomes, even if the bigger world around them is full of changes they might not yet comprehend. For NPR News, I'm Libby Rainey in Los Angeles.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, the difficulty of confronting death when it's your adolescent child who's dying. Even some in the medical field don't talk about death realistically with child patients or their families. When is hope helpful, and when is it just denial? We talk with Sarah Wildman of the New York Times. Her daughter died of cancer at age 14. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at Viking.com. From Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at ImaginableFutures.com. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. The tariffs have arrived. Over the weekend, President Trump hit Canada and Mexico with 25% tariffs on most imports to the U.S. and an additional 10% on China. During the presidential campaign, Trump said tariffs would not cause Americans to pay higher prices. He now says Americans may face some costs.
We may have short-term some little pain, and people understand that. But long-term, the United States has been ripped off by virtually every country in the world.
Wasn't clear what he meant by that. Canadians contend they buy a lot of American goods and sell Americans a lot of cheap oil. Trump said the tariffs were about fentanyl. Leaders of Canada and Mexico ordered retaliatory tariffs on American imports. Canadian sports fans found their own ways to retaliate.
That was booing you heard there at the national anthem. This was at the Ottawa Senators hockey game, as heard here on the CBC.
Trump told reporters he's not done. He says future tariffs, quote, will definitely be imposed on the European Union and, quote, might happen against the UK. He did not offer a timeline beyond saying they'll come, quote, pretty soon.
If you like to go to parties, or even if you just walk down the street in many places, then you already know marijuana has come out of the shadows. The number of Americans who say they use marijuana has more than doubled over the last decade, that according to a Gallup survey. In nearly half the states, weed is legal for recreational use under state law, and many Americans use it the same way they might have a beer or a glass of wine.
For all that acceptance, finding marijuana products that are safe, safely sourced, properly regulated, is tricky. So in the coming weeks, NPR is going to be looking at how consumers can best navigate the new world of weed.
Here to do this with us, our NPR addiction correspondent, Brian Mann. Brian, welcome.
Hi there.
And NPR's Sydney Lupkin, who covers the pharmaceutical industry. Welcome to you, Sydney.
Hi.
So, Brian, let me just start by asking this, if that's okay. Are there health risks associated with marijuana?
There are. You know, experts say that as cannabis products become more powerful and more Americans consume a lot more marijuana more often, there are significant risks to brain function and mental health. Now, that's also true, of course, for alcohol. So it's important to say as we go forward, we're offering information to help cannabis consumers who do choose to partake.
So, Sydney, if somebody does choose to partake, is there something that can go wrong when it comes to quality? What is it that regulators are worried about, and what should consumers be worried about?
Yeah, so usually regulators are looking to keep out pesticides, mold, bacteria, and heavy metals like arsenic, which can come from the soil. All of those things have the potential to cause harm either in the short term with like an ER visit for vomiting, for example, or in the long term, increasing your risk for certain cancers or neurological problems. But it's tricky because on the federal level, cannabis is still illegal. Not every state has legalized cannabis, and those that have may regulate it very differently. I spoke to Maxwell Lung, an assistant professor at Arizona State University, who did a study in 2022 about sort of that patchwork of cannabis regulations.
We find that there are over 600 contaminants that are regulated across some 30 states that have legalized cannabis at that time. But interestingly, in each jurisdiction, there's only anywhere between 60 to 120 contaminants that are regulated.
And what that translates into for consumers, Michelle, is that a pesticide that might prompt one state to pull cannabis off the shelf, another state might not even be looking for it.
That's right, but just testing for more contaminants doesn't necessarily make a state's cannabis products safer. And that's because it's really early days when it comes to the research. So it's hard to say which contaminants are the most hazardous to human health.
And Brian, you've been telling us that the black market for marijuana is still booming. How does that complicate things for consumers?
Yeah, even advocates of marijuana decriminalization say this part has been a mess. As Sydney points out, there are conflicting regulations state by state. Cannabis is still illegal under federal law, which means properly regulated products can't be shipped legally from one state to the next. And those restrictions have left this huge opening for underground producers and distributors, some backed by criminal gangs. NPR has found those products are often grown and processed in really unsanitary conditions with banned pesticides, also really unhealthy conditions for workers. And these illegal growers typically don't have trustworthy potency guidelines. I spoke about all this with Paul Armentano. He's head of NORML. That's the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws.
We're talking about a market that lacks transparency and accountability. Whether I was getting cannabis or alcohol or my broccoli from an entirely unregulated market, I'd be concerned about any number of issues.
And even many storefront shops around the U.S. are actually selling illegal weed. This is one of the biggest challenges for consumers right now. If you want legal weed, you have to do your research and really understand how your cannabis products are sourced. And that's not always easy.
So Brian, when is this confusion going to clear up?
The people I talked to, the experts, say they think this is going to happen slowly. And they reminded me that the end of alcohol prohibition, remember back in the 1930s, as that was phased out, it was also messy. It took years for legal alcohol brewers and legal distillers to sort of push out the illegal moonshine operators. Legal cannabis producers are hoping the same thing will happen here. Over time, these safer, more regulated marijuana brands will win out. And in time, theoretically, that's going to make it a lot easier for consumers to know which products to just grab off the shelf.
Right. So legal weed is probably more likely to be free of many contaminants like pesticides and mold because states are testing them and they're pulling them off the shelves. In California, where an official told me it has the largest legal cannabis market in the world by volume, there were more than 60 recalls in 2024. And that includes flower, pre-rolls, edibles, and vape products. It's up from just 4 cannabis recalls the year before. The big increase is because of, I'm told, more testing. In Maine, which has a newer system, it just issued its first cannabis recall ever this year, and that was for mold. So researchers are still looking at how effective these consumer protections might be. But for now, if you're getting your cannabis in a store that has regulated products, there is less risk of encountering at least some of the contaminants.
That was NPR's Brian Mann and Sydney Lupkin. Their series continues in the coming weeks. Later today on All Things Considered, they'll look at the patchwork of state regulations that are supposed to ensure the safety of the legal weed supply. Listen live on the NPR app or your local station. This is NPR News.
Be welcome to one of the wonders of the world. Be welcome to the Panama Canal.
The Panama Canal. President Trump says we're taking it back. And his new Secretary of State is in Panama to push the case. Many locals are shocked.
That was something that we weren't expecting, you know, in our 2025 bingo card.
I'm Ari Shapiro, hosting All Things Considered from the Panama Canal on NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The Premier of Ontario is among those expressing frustration that President Trump plans to impose 25% tariffs on goods imported from Canada and Mexico beginning tomorrow.
We just do not understand him spending time and energy on his closest friend, his treasured ally, since 1867. Like, there's more problems in the world than attacking your closest friend.
That's Ontario Premier Doug Ford speaking to Fox News. Trump says he's imposing the tariffs along with a 10% tax on goods imported from China because of the illegal flow of drugs and immigrants into the U.S. Ford says that will mean higher prices for everyone.
What's going to happen is very simple. Inflation is going to happen in the U.S. It's going to happen in Canada. It's like buying a pickup truck manufactured here is going to cost Americans 25% more, and vice versa.
Speaking to reporters yesterday, Trump acknowledged American consumers could see higher prices in the short term. Ford says Ontario is responding to the tariffs in part by banning government contracts with American companies. Vice President Vance and EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin are traveling to East Palestine, Ohio today. They're marking 2 years since a Norfolk Southern freight train derailed in the village near the Pennsylvania border. This is NPR News. Divers continue to work in the Potomac River near Washington, D.C. to recover human remains and locate wreckage from last week's mid-air collision between an American Airlines regional jet and a military helicopter. 55 of the 67 people killed have been positively identified. Astronomers are keeping a watchful eye on a large asteroid said to be years away from threatening Earth. Scientists say it has a 1 in 63 chance of hitting Earth in 8 years. But as NPR's Scott Newman reports, the odds of a miss may go up over time.
Known as 2024 YR4, the asteroid could be up to 300 feet in diameter. An impact from an object that big could do significant damage if it hit a populated area. But Paul Chodas, director of NASA JPL Center for Near Earth Object Studies, stresses that the odds are still in our favor.
The impact probability could continue to rise, but the odds are it will fall to zero at some point. And there's a 98.4 chance that it will not impact, so that's the most likely situation.
Chodas and others hope to rule out an Earth strike by mid-April, when the asteroid will become too dim to see even in the largest telescopes. They won't get another look at it until 2028. Scott Newman, NPR News.
I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm, arm.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at metamucil.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is in Washington today, the first foreign leader to visit President Trump this term. And he arrives as negotiations for the next phase of a ceasefire deal with Hamas get underway. We've called Israel's ambassador to the United Nations, Danny Danon, who is also a member of the Prime Minister's Likud party. Ambassador, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you for having me.
What does the Prime Minister hope to accomplish with his visit, I mean?
Well, first, we appreciate the fact that Prime Minister Netanyahu was invited to be the first foreign leader to visit the White House. It means a lot to us, and it proves the strong bond between the U.S. and Israel. We have a lot to discuss. You know, we have the hostages, we have Iran threats in the region, Lebanon, Syria, Yemen. We have a lot of enemies, we have a lot of challenges that are threatening only also the U.S. So I think the meeting will be a long meeting, a productive meeting, and hopefully we'll start working with our allies about how to tackle those challenges.
So much to discuss. You named a bunch of things. I want to drill down on a couple. You mentioned Iran. Do you believe the United States and Israel agree on an approach to Iran at this time? And if so, what is it?
Well, I think we definitely agree that we cannot allow Iran to obtain nuclear weapons. We know they breached all the agreements. They deceived the international community. And also they spent billions on their proxies. And all the problems we have today, whether it's in Lebanon, in Syria, in Gaza, in Yemen, it all comes from Iran. You know, the money that they spend over the years for weapons and training. So I think that will be the first topic to discuss. And there are the different ways to deal with the Iranian threat. I believe President Trump when he said that he will not allow Iran to become a nuclear power.
We'll just note that Israel has struck very effectively against one Iranian proxy after another throughout the entire region. Iran would very much seem to be on the back foot. Is this a moment for further actions against Iran?
Well, I believe that, you know, we should not wait for the day that we will find out that they became nuclear. If you look at what happened with North Korea, you know, the West waited for too long. We cannot allow that. And also the fact that we saw that they actually targeted Israel with hundreds of ballistic missiles, it shows their intentions. You know, just imagine what would have happened if they already obtained the nuclear capabilities and actually were able to put them on ballistic missiles. Mm-hmm. So we cannot wait too long.
Military strikes are possible then against the nuclear facilities?
I think all options should be discussed. All options should be on the table. The goal should be that Iran will not be nuclear. By the way, it's not going to be only our request. I think President Trump will hear it from many leaders that will come to see him from the Middle East.
Let me ask about where things are going in Gaza. The new president made a statement about his preference to clear out the population, or nearly all the population. I think he said 1.5 million people, talked of moving them to Egypt and Jordan, which doesn't seem to be interested in taking them, and the Palestinians who live in Gaza don't seem to be interested in going anywhere. But I'm not sure that I understand what your government's plan is for Gaza. Who's supposed to be running it in the near future, and what happens to the people there?
Well, I can tell you that we have no intention to stay in Gaza. We left Gaza in 2005, and unfortunately, instead of building their own future, Hamas took over, and we saw the results. One thing for sure we know, that we will not allow Hamas to stay in power. I think you're going to have two phases. In the interim phase, you will need the support of the international community to rebuild Gaza, to build a new leadership. And then in the future, hopefully there will be a genuine leadership that will support peace, coexistence, and will not support radical ideas like Hamas.
Just so I understand, there's a few seconds left, Ambassador. You're telling me that Israel's committed that Israel is not going to retake or re-annex that land and that the Palestinians will remain there? That is your intent?
Absolutely. We have no intention to go back into Gaza or to annex Gaza, but we will not allow Hamas to stay there. We have to find another solution for the future, for the people of Gaza, not only for our security.
Danny Danon is Israel's ambassador to the United Nations. He speaks on this morning when Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is in Washington, D.C. for a meeting with President Trump. Ambassador, pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Now to a major event in this country. More than 100,000 people are expected to head to New Orleans for Sunday's Super Bowl, just weeks after the New Year's Day terror attack on Bourbon Street. Joseph King with the Gulf States Newsroom reports on the security preparations underway.
The law enforcement presence in New Orleans is intense this week. There's already been more police around Bourbon Street ever since the attack. Now, Louisiana Governor Jeff Landry is using an executive order to add checkpoints.
The Louisiana State Police will develop and publish to the public the specific geographical boundaries of the enhanced security zone around the French Quarter.
This means starting Wednesday in the French Quarter, you can't carry ice coolers. Also, handbags larger than 4 by 6 inches are not allowed. Landry says the public has a part to play.
Public safety is a team sport. Just like football, just like basketball, soccer, it's a team sport.
He is urging people to routinely check social media for public safety updates, and full cooperation with law enforcement is required.
If an officer at the enhanced security checkpoint in the quarter asks to search your bag that you're carrying in excess of the size limitations, you are free to refuse it, but you are not free to enter.
The same limitations will be in place at the Superdome for the game Sunday night. The Super Bowl is a SEER 1 event, which stands for Special Event Assessment Rating by Homeland Security. It means it has federal law enforcement support, says Kathy Lanier, the NFL's chief security officer.
A lot more visible law enforcement presence and a lot more hardened security perimeters.
Meaning armored cars, surveillance drones, agents on rooftops, and hundreds of law enforcement officers. Juliet Kayyem is a Homeland Security expert who worked for the Obama administration. She says keeping the game safe will not be as difficult as securing the French Quarter.
It's a little bit, in a weird way, easier than Bourbon Street, which is open by design. A stadium is not open by design, and therefore it's easier to fortify, even though it's a much bigger event.
The next big thing for New Orleans will be Mardi Gras on March 4th, which the governor has already declared another high security event. For NPR News, I'm Joseph King in New Orleans.
This is NPR News.
We've all been guilty of mispronouncing a common word from time to time. Parmesan cheese, anyone? Our occasional look at commonly mispronounced words next time on Here and Now.
From your car radio to your smart speaker, NPR meets you where you are in a lot of different ways. Now we're in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. Punxsutawney Phil popped out, looked around, and saw his shadow, which means 6 more weeks of winter, we're told. Now, his track record is not exactly stellar. The National Centers for Environmental Information says Phil has gotten it right only about 30% of the time over the last decade. It's a tradition, though, that dates back to the late 1800s, happening over and over and over again, as Bill Murray could tell you. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The Grammy Awards ended on a note that many in the music industry were waiting for. Here's host Trevor Noah.
We finally saw it happen, everyone. Beyoncé has just won Album of the Year.
It took until now? NPR's Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento reports.
Even before last night, Beyoncé was already the most awarded artist in Grammy history. But she had never won the award for Album of the Year, a point which had become something of an issue for the Grammys. That's changed now, thanks to her genre-spanning album, Cowboy Carter.
16 carriages driving away while I watch them ride.
In her acceptance speech, the Texas singer acknowledged her history with the Grammys, and she singled out one influence, Black country music pioneer Linda Martell.
I want to dedicate this to Miss Martell, and I hope we just keep pushing forward, opening doors.
The other two major prizes of the night, Song of the Year and Record of the Year, went to rapper Kendrick Lamar and his song, Not Like Us.
They not like us. They not like us. They not like us.
Not Like Us is a remarkably venomous song to have won major awards. The diss track came out of Lamar's ferocious battle with Drake last year. And in recent months, it's been the focus of a lawsuit by Drake against Universal Music Group, the label that represents both artists. In his acceptance speeches, Lamar made no mention of Drake, but focused on his hometown of Los Angeles.
We're gonna dedicate this one to the city. Compton, Watts, yeah, yeah. Long Beach, Inglewood.
Recovery efforts for Los Angeles were a constant theme throughout the Grammys in speeches, video packages, advertisements, requests for donations from host Trevor Noah, and performances. Like when LA natives Billie Eilish and Phineas played Birds of a Feather in front of images of the siblings as kids in Southern California. One highlight was a tribute to late producer Quincy Jones that featured legends Herbie Hancock and Stevie Wonder. And younger artists were also well represented. All eight of the Best New Artist nominees performed. That category was one of the most competitive this year, with nominees including chart toppers like Shaboozey and Sabrina Carpenter. Ultimately, the award went to Chapel Roan. In her trademark flamboyant makeup and costuming, Roan delivered an electrifying rendition of her hit Pink Pony Club about finding community in an LA gay bar. During her Best New Artist acceptance speech, Roan called out the music industry for not doing enough to make sure artists have livable wages and access to healthcare.
Labels, we got you, but do you got us?
Two more artists who broke through in 2024 each took home a pair of awards. Sabrina Carpenter in the pop categories and Charlie XCX for dance and electronic. It's okay to just admit that you're jealous of me. The Grammys also recognize artists working outside of the mainstream. Earlier in the afternoon, the Academy handed out dozens of awards across a wide range of genres. Sierra Ferrell swept the roots and Americana categories. St. Vincent took home several rock and alternative music Grammys. Samara Joy picked up a pair of jazz awards. And in classical, Gabriela Ortiz and the LA Philharmonic won three Grammys for a recording of her composition, Revolución Diamantina. Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
are watching Financial Markets Digest news of tariffs.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Glassdoor. See who's hiring, what they're paying, and join conversations with professionals in the new Glassdoor community, now with expert tips for career success from best-selling work-life author Adam Grant, all on the Glassdoor app. And by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. President Trump is holding calls with the leaders of Mexico and Canada this morning after the administration imposed new tariffs on imports from America's three largest trading partners, 10% on Canadian energy imports, 25% on everything else from both countries. Also, under the Economic Emergency Declaration, moving China tariffs up by another 10%. If this is a negotiating tactic, as some have suggested, there isn't much time. The import taxes kick in just over 13 hours, midnight Eastern. Marketplace's Nova Safo has more.
The tariffs President Trump announced affect a far bigger chunk of the U.S. economy than the ones he imposed during his first term.
It was larger and more forceful than we were expecting in our baseline forecast.
Kathy Bosjancic is chief economist at Nationwide Financial.
So depending if they actually do get enacted and you see Canada and Mexico retaliate as they've indicated they would, that could shave about 2 full percentage points off of GDP growth.
That means the economy could see almost no growth this year and could potentially even dip into recession, including job losses. Inflation could increase perhaps about 0.6 percentage point, and in some areas, prices would rise far more than in others.
For instance, you know, for auto prices, we could see a jump of 10%.
Grocery prices could rise, so could prices at the pump. A rise in lumber prices could increase the cost of building homes. Smartphones and other electronics made in China could become more expensive. In general, analysts say the new tariffs are likely to cost American households about $1,000 to $1,200 a year. The president's order also removes an exemption which allowed packages worth less than $800 to come into the country tax-free. That means those purchases from Temu and Shein and other low-cost Chinese retailers will face import taxes for the first time. I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
There's word just now from Mexico's president saying she has reached a deal to delay U.S. tariffs on Mexico. This would be a pause, not a long-term resolution. President Sheinbaum says the deal includes 10,000 Mexican National Guard troops to reinforce the U.S. border. She says the U.S. will now work to stop high-powered weapons trafficking to Mexico. No confirmation of this yet from the Washington side. On all of this news, the stock market is paring back its earlier losses. The Dow is down 171 points now, 0.4%. The S&P down 0.8%. The NASDAQ is down 1%. Economist Julia Coronado is founder of Macro Policy Perspectives. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
I'm seeing a crummy day, but I don't see panic or anything.
Not a lot of panic in the stock market. Definitely some negative sentiment, but there's still people holding out hope that this will be resolved fairly quickly. So it's not the full-blown panic you might see.
Just to pick one sector, automotive, to get specific here, yes, the stock in German car makers down sharply this morning, but also the U.S.-based ones. I mean, General Motors is opening quite low this morning.
That's right. Some analysts estimate this could boost the average car price by about $3,000. So that would certainly keep some people from buying cars.
All right. Well, we'll watch that sector and many others. Economist Julia Coronado is also a professor at the University of Texas, Austin. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Again, Mexico says it has negotiated a temporary reprieve from tariffs. We haven't heard yet from Canada. The VIX index of stock market volatility is up 11%, so still nervous, but not as much as an hour ago. With higher tariffs promised, stock in German car companies are down 4.4% for VW. Here, GM shares are off of their lows of the morning, but still down 1.7%. The Canadian dollar has recovered some losses just now, but it's still down 0.2%, with one U.S. dollar costing $1.45.6 Canadian. The peso's down 0.9%, 20.5.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Rubrik. When cyber attacks come for the cloud and threaten business operations, Rubrik gives you the power to bounce back fast. More at Rubrik.com. And by Progressive Insurance. The Name Your Price tool provides a range of coverage options. Progressive.com. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And by Clear Channel Outdoor, an out-of-home billboard company that offers data-driven advertising solutions for businesses big and small. Billboardsforbusiness.com.
Now to word about access to the financial plumbing of the U.S. Department of Treasury. Here's Marketplace's Kimberly Adams.
Good morning, David.
Tell me more about this payments system here.
It's called the Bureau of Fiscal Service, and like you mentioned, it's part of the Treasury Department. It's sort of like accounts payable for the federal government, and it handles almost $6 trillion in payments for things like Social Security, tax refunds, federal grants payments, even payments to some contractors. So almost 90% of federal checks going out the door move through this system, so it affects millions of Americans and American businesses.
Now we have the New York Times and Politico reporting that this government efficiency panel advising the administration, that's the one with Musk at the helm, now have access to this important system. This appears to have prompted the resignation of the Treasury official who had been running that division. Why is this system a priority for these government cost cutters?
Elon Musk claimed on his platform X that Treasury officials were regularly approving fraudulent or illegal payments, although he didn't provide any evidence for this, and there is a system in place to prevent that from happening, but it's part of a broader effort to just sort of rein in government spending in general.
And what are we hearing in response?
Democratic Senators Elizabeth Warren and Ron Wyden, both ranking members on two Senate financial committees, have sent letters to Treasury demanding more information about what's going on. They're calling these moves concerning and dangerous, as well as a risk to national security. Because this system contains a ton of data about individual Americans and businesses. They also flagged Elon Musk's business relationships with China, arguing those connections create an even greater risk when he has access to data like this.
Marketplace's senior Washington correspondent Kimberly Adams, thank you.
You're welcome, David.
And from Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio. This is the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.